Welcome to today's episode of Just Cause. Today's episode is a special one because we're speaking to Toronto Police Deputy Chief Peter Ewan on one of his last days before retiring from the service. And I'm really honored to say that this podcast episode is his last official interview. So thank you very much for that, Peter. I will apologize for some of the sound quality issues in today's episode because we did have some technical difficulties and we needed to end up recording on Peter's phone. So bear with us, it is a great episode and we really hope you enjoy it. Now, just before we dive into it, I want to share a little bit more around Peter and his background. As a senior police leader with the largest municipal police service in Canada, Deputy Chief Peter Ewan is in charge of the Community Safety Command, which provides proactive and reactive public safety services and programs in partnership with diverse communities and key stakeholders. As Deputy Chief, Peter has been responsible for all frontline policing and oversees 12 districts, consisting of 16 divisions in Toronto. He's also in charge of field services, which encompasses the Toronto Police Operations Centre, communication services, traffic services, parking enforcement, the public safety response team, and the community partnerships and engagement unit. Peter is most proud of the meaningful partnerships he has developed and expanded that are most relevant to the heart of the community, including the Neighborhood Community Officer Program and the expansion of the Mobile Crisis Intervention Team Program. Peter has acquired an extensive variety of professional experience spanning over 34 years of policing, including uniform patrol, undercover work, criminal investigation, community response, Asian organized crime, the homicide squad, human resources, duty operations, and corporate risk management. Peter has been recognized as an Asian organized crime expert by the Courts of Ontario and has spoken both nationally and internationally on this topic, including addressing the Justice Committee in Ottawa, the International Council for Refugees, and the National Organized Crime Committee. Peter has an excellent track record for impacting police policy, and he believes in community-focused policing that is accountable and transparent. He launched a comprehensive internal review of the Toronto Police Service's search of persons procedure and directed a complete overhaul of this procedure, training, and audit processes, resulting in the Ontario Independent Police Review Director declaring the changes as the gold standard that all other police services across Ontario should follow. Moving forward, Peter is exploring the use of technology to create innovative ways to further decrease the number of strip searches and support personal dignity. Peter was born in Hong Kong, and he immigrated to Canada with his family in 1975. He is proud of his Chinese heritage and his Canadian citizenship. From a lens of his own personal experiences with diversity, Peter actively seeks out honest public discourse and community input on policing issues, management, and social justice issues. Peter is a member of the Toronto Police Services Board Anti-Racism Advisory Panel, a member of the Toronto Police Services Board Mental Health and Addictions Advisory Panel, the National Use of Force Committee, the Ontario Regional Chair of the National Justice Committee, co-chair of the Toronto Police Service Mobile Crisis Intervention Team Steering Committee, and senior advisor both to the East and South Asian Internal Support Networks. Always championing the voices of the community, Peter serves as an executive member of the service's race-based data collection strategy. He believes that in order to combat systemic racism, we must first understand it and the community must have an input on what is collected, stored, analyzed, and shared. With the help of 30 community organizations and service liaison committees, he coordinated the largest community engagement venture the Toronto Police has ever endeavored, meeting with almost 900 people from all walks of life, from every corner of the city for their input to help shape police policy. Peter has a Bachelor of Applied Arts degree in Justice Studies from the University of Guelph and a Master of Arts degree in Leadership from the University of Guelph. And he is also the recipient of numerous different awards internally and externally.
With us today is Deputy Chief Peter Ewan. I am so happy to have him today because recently, very recently, he just put in his retirement papers officially after a 35-year career. And Peter, thank you very much for agreeing to do this. I imagine it's probably one of your last interviews, so I hope this will be a little bit more fun for you.
Well, Rhianne, thank you for inviting me. It is my last interview, and I hope my last will be the best, but I'm keeping my fingers crossed, and it's a pleasure. You know, you and I have known each other for a long time, and when you offer me the opportunity to come to speak on your podcast, I thought I couldn't turn this down. You know what? Yes, it's been 35 years, and you know, you look back, it was like yesterday. And when I first joined the job, at that time, Metro Toronto Police Service, I did not believe I would be working 35 years. When you're in the early 20s, I just gave away my age. Too bad. When you're in the early 20s, and 35 years is a lifetime, and I never thought of it. But when you're looking back, and wow, it just went by so quickly. And certainly, a lot of people said, "Was that did you think that you would be a deputy chief?" I said, "No, I thought I wanted to be a Toronto Police Service, a Metro Toronto Police officer, to do a good job and to serve the public." You know what? Journey that I took, you know, I never thought of that. You know, it's, in my world, this is only personally, I set goals for myself, but you certainly don't look at 35 years, 32 years and say, I'm going to be deputy chief. You will do, you know, my dad always taught me, just reach for the top, do it. As long as you give 100% each and everything you do, at the end of the day, if it's not successful, and you can always say to yourself, I gave it my best. It's like, you know, you see the Olympians. I see, you know, the Paralympics, you know, I saw a basketball game of the Paralympics, and I saw the young men, they were crying. They weren't crying because they lost, because they knew they give it their best, but that country came in last. And you know what? That's the spirit. You know, that's the way we should live our lives. Not because every time, certainly we want to compete, and we want to compete fairly and ethically, but you know, you have to give your best. And that was my mindset from day one. And you know, I still have that mindset. So that's how I live my life. And thank you for giving me this opportunity again.
Oh, well, I'm so pleased we could do it, Peter. Thinking back now, you know, obviously now that you're leaving this chapter of your life and career, do you remember what it felt like when you were getting ready to, you know, go into the police college, do your training, become a rookie? Do you remember how you were feeling at that time and what was driving you to go into policing?
You know, I repeated this story many times. You know, as many people know that I came here as an immigrant from Hong Kong, very young age. My parents wanted to bring myself, my brother, and my sister here to give us a good education and a place where opportunities can be had. And it's like any, you know, it's no different than any immigrant families. My parents work 12-hour shifts, so I don't see both of them very often. I see one, and then the other ones go off to work. So I was there to look after my younger brothers and sister, and it was very difficult growing up. You know, we weren't poor, but certainly by no means were rich, and so we knew, you know, to work hard. And as a immigrant family, you know what I did? I think I did quite well in high school, and I went to university, and then this is where the story begins. Mm-hmm. I told my dad that I wanted to go to York University to take European history. I think if he had a gun in the house, I would have been, you know, shot.
Oh my goodness.
Immigrant families don't go to take European history. Go for engineering, doctors, lawyers, accountants, pharmacists. So my dad said, well, you know, you pick one. And I said, I don't want to. Well, you will. So I picked engineering. I went to McMaster. And after 2 years, I dropped out. I wasn't enjoying it. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, so when I speak with young people, I said, you know what? First of all, it's not fair for an 18-year-old, 17-year-old to determine what career path he or she will take. But I also say to them, think of what you're going to do. Have a, you know, plan. You know, and I see the new generations. They're not tied. They're not bound to one career. So that's good. One occupation. So after 2 years, I dropped out and I told my dad, I'm just not interested. And so I start helping out at the family restaurant. But you know, that I knew that wasn't something I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So, and by chance, I was, you know, and I had two uncles. One in Saskatoon and one in Vancouver. They're both police officers. So policing in the Ewan family is a, you know, it's not foreign. So my uncle was a RCMP officer. My uncle is now a retired Saskatoon detective, Saskatoon PD. So I looked up to him and to them. And but so one day I was walking downtown and I saw a recruiting booth and I said, the gentleman, I think I remember he had a heavy Scottish accent. You know, that's how policing were, you know, all Scottish and Irish. And young man, you're interested? I said, yeah. Let's see, you know. Yeah. But so I applied with no expectations, and I didn't tell my parents until they have to do a home visit. That's when, you know, yikes. So they came and they spoke with my parents. My parents said, you know what? When I joined the job, before I became a police officer, my dad said, can you promise me one thing? I said, what's that, mom and dad? We want our kids to have post-secondary education. I said, Dad, yeah, I'll promise you that. So give me some time. So, you know, we had fast forward and all that. 20 years after I got my undergrad and I also got my master's degree. So to make sure that I fulfill my promise to my parents.
That's fantastic.
When I graduated, unfortunately, when I got my undergrad and my master's, my mom was not able to see it because she passed away at a very early age. So that is some of the that is a regret that I cannot share that the joy with her. So I became a police officer, 1987, you know, February 3rd. So what were my expectations? I had none. But all I knew was it was a strange place. And people say, what do you mean strange place? We had a class of 110. I think there were only three racialized people in there. Wow. I said, wow. But, you know, growing up in Toronto, I grew up in East York. I went to Cardinal Newman. So I was used to the mixed population. Mm-hmm. But still, it was, okay. You know, so I learned from an early stage, in order to belong, I better get along. So there were racial jokes. They were stereotypes. But, you know, you have to, you know, so the line I just said, you better get along if you want to belong. So I did that. So I became a police officer, you know, through training, and I did okay. And then I came out and I posted at various stations. And my career, I would say to you, if someone asked me about my career, I said, I've been blessed. I was given a lot of opportunities. And, you know, so there's where I'm going to pause and say, you know, a lot of racialized individuals, they say they're not given opportunities. And I'll say to them, have you tried your best? If you haven't tried your best, you can't use your identity, your gender, who you are, and say you're not given an opportunity. But on the other hand, am I saying that there are no systemic barriers or racism? I'm not saying that. It still exists to this day. Whether it's Toronto Police Service or any banks or any public servant, public and private entities, it exists, you know. But back then, we did not understand the terminology, white privilege, systemic racism, you know. We just microaggressions. Those were not the vocabularies of the day. But if you look at in retrospect, looking back, I said, wow, I experienced all that stuff. So this is another word that we're going to use is live experience. Back then, there were no live experience. But one thing I do know, I can say is when I joined, the service was drastically different than today. It was a warrior mentality. It was us against them. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like watching a television show. You know, we are cops. We do what's right. We tell you what to do. And so it was a lot of drinking, a lot of, you know, these, you know, socializing. Those were the culture of the day. So, you know, I'm happy to say that's 35 years, the culture has changed. It's changed for better. But can we do better? Of course we can do better. But one thing I do remember, because up to my last 2 weeks, I delivered the last presentation to new recruits. So for the last 15 years, Rihanna, every new recruit, the last presentation they get before they get deployed is by Pete Ewan. So I was a different rank superintendent, staff superintendent, deputy chief, or even staff inspector. It was a 2-hour customer service. When, you know, I remember working with, a good friend of mine, Peter Slowly. He said to me, Pete, we need customer service. I said, customer service? We never taught that. He said, exactly. I want you to develop a customer service curriculum to be taught to new recruits, new supervisors, and new senior officers. I said, you're asking me? I remember delivering the first customer service presentation to our senior officers. Mm-hmm. They were throwing rocks at me. they're laughing at me. We don't do these things. We don't provide customer service. So when I first joined the job in 1987, we did not have customer service lectures. We did not know what it was. I think I have presented to over 1,500 new recruits. And, you know, I don't remember all the faces, but as a deputy chief, I get to see people sometimes at headquarters or during different events throughout the city. They say, deputy. And I'll say, hi. And they said, I remember your customer service lecture. You know, everything you taught us. And, you know, that to me really means, you know, if you say a return on investment or brings a smile warms my heart, a little smile to my face. Yeah. So policing has evolved greatly. You know, just as simple as customer service. You know, we don't teach that. We did not know what it is. Mm-hmm. So that's why, you know, that warrior in 1987, we were warriors. We're here to clean up the streets. Now we're here to deliver service along with other agencies. Mm-hmm. So I hope I answer your question in a long,
No, there's so many aspects of what you've just been talking about that I want to dive into. First, just because you were mentioning the recruit graduation, I know that your son has recently joined. Were you providing a speech to his graduation, or were you more like there as a support and encouragement for him? Well, how's he finding it so far? What advice did you give him?
So remember I said earlier, I didn't want to do engineering.
Yes.
My wife and I would let my son decide what he wants to do. So he decided to take engineering. I said, am I living a bad dream? My son wants to be it. So he got an engineering degree, and I saw how hard he worked. Mm-hmm. You know, during his third or fourth year, he'll be staying up all night, you know, getting 1 hour sleep and right doing projects. And so he graduated with honors, and he was working as an engineer. Mm-hmm. You know, I think these stories repeats itself. After 18 months, almost 2 years as an engineer, he came home and said, and I still remember New Year's Day, he said he wanted to see my wife and I. I said, New Year's Day, well, what does he want from us, right? He said that I joined the Toronto Police Service. I said, you know, I know this is a professional podcast. I can't use certain words, but I said, what? Talking about? Yeah, I just submitted a form. He wanted to be a police officer. And he says, I like the work. I see what you do. And plus, he was an auxiliary. June is an auxiliary officer. That works with the Toronto Police Service. They have a uniform, but they don't have use of force. They don't have authorities, but they're volunteers. And my son really enjoyed the camaraderies and the teamwork and serving the public. And he's like me. He says, I can't see myself being an engineer for the rest of my life, you know. So he joined, and that was 18 months ago. So now he's doing quite well. And yes, before he graduated, he was in his class of, I think, 80, and I delivered the same customer service presentation. But I do recall that the night before the presentation, he asked my wife to tell me, make sure I don't ask him any questions. He didn't want to be embarrassed. So he received the same presentation. So I wish him all the best. You know what? He's new. He's less than 2 years. He's going to see things. You know, I always say this. I say this to whether you're a veteran or a new recruit. We didn't join a happy business. It's not shock and awe, but it's a business where we're dealing with people's crisis. We're seeing the people at the worst. And sometimes it's human misery. We're not in a happy business. So we have to have a number of things that was never taught to me. Mm-hmm. You have to learn. This is lifelong learning. But I'm giving the new recruits a head start. You have to have empathy. Mm-hmm. You have to have compassion. You have to have understanding. And you have to have good communication skills. And it's not about you. It's about the person who are calling you. It doesn't matter if a person just lost a cell phone or lost a loved one. They need to be treated the same. How you treat the person, it should be fair, equitable, and consistent. Consistent from the beginning till the end. And you need to do, you know, a little bit of going back you know, and looking and checking on people. So that's what I, it's not, we call that, you know, some people call it drive-by. We're not in a drive-by business. We do aftercares. Mm-hmm. So remember those words. And, you know, it's not difficult. I always say to recruits, and I say to, you know, people around, you know, senior officers, as supervisors, you have loved ones. They would be driving through Toronto, any region. Would you want a loved one to be treated awful by even just through a traffic stop or coming to their homes to deal with a policing matter? And we hear those stories as police officers. So now you're now the person. So think, you know, Rianne, it's not a surprise that we're seeing our public trust and satisfaction dip almost to below 80%. That's unheard of. So is it partial? Is it out? Is it a responsibility of Toronto Police Service? Of course it is. You know, obviously there are a whole host of external context, the external environments, the social medias and different entities. But we are the one being judged. Or being measured, and we need to bring those numbers back up. There is a critical issue of public trust right now with the city of Toronto, and the public trust is vitally important for how we provide services. And I see the public trust issue is because Toronto is the most diverse city in the world. You cannot treat different communities same way. Each community has their own wants, own needs, and you have to understand, you know, so as a police officer, you have to stay current. Mm-hmm. You know, if I have a chance today to speak with new recruits, you know, the first thing I'll say to them today, I'll ask them what's going on in the world. And if they cannot tell me there's a war going on, then I will have them stand up and explain to me why. I'll say to you, because I experienced this, a new recruit say, "Deputy, why would I care as a Toronto police officer? A war is going on in Russia." Yes, you will, because there are Russian communities here. There are Ukrainian communities here. People are grieving. People are hurt. Mm-hmm. There will be protests. There will be different narratives. And you may be pit against an argument, a dispute between a Russian person and a Ukrainian person. If you don't know it, you don't know what's going on around you. Anything that happens in this world impacts you as a Toronto police officer. It doesn't matter what rank you hold, it impacts. So that's the way I like to educate them. I like to get their minds thinking. But unfortunately, I'm retiring, so I don't have that opportunity to speak with any recruits. But I will ask my son, what do you think? Because at least it's still in my household, so I can have a chance to speak with him. I say, you know what? What do you think? You know, so that's how I think. Those are the important things to build up public trust. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Because people want to see themselves reflected in public services, particularly police, because of the close involvement that comes when the police are involved and knowing the world around them and how it affects the communities here. I mean, there are so many different populations, refugee populations who are coming from places where trust in the police is very low. So trying to get them to suddenly trust us just because they're here now, it's a big undertaking. There's so many cultural differences, years of issues. If I think about some of the things the service is trying to do around building relationships with the LGBTQ2+ community, there's a lot that's happening there as well that needs to be done, especially with Bruce MacArthur and the missing persons inquiry. Thinking more broadly around public trust, Peter, I mean, what else do you think the TPS should do going forward to try and build this? I mean, I know there's different initiatives that I'd love to hear from you about around some of the mental health care and the race-based statistics that are happening, some of the things that you've been leading to help try and improve that. What are some of your thoughts around where to take this?
Yeah, as a deputy chief, so we get assigned, corporate files. You know, so some of the files that I've been privilege to be associated with and working with fine women and men, both internal and external members. You know, the mental health file, expanding the MC Mobile Crisis Intervention Team, you know, the race-based data collection strategy. These are things that, and the community neighborhood program, you know, these are things that all build public trust. So let's start with the race-based data collection. Mm-hmm. It's controversial, but the Liberal government before, you know, we have conservative, they wanted to have all police services collect race-based data. And it's not to stigmatize community, it's to understand why we're doing certain things, why certain populations, certain communities have been subjected to more strip searches, use of force. And it's not to say that those communities are bad, but now, you know, we have to convince. Convince is a good word, because the public trust is low. When I went and did a public engagement, because before we launch our Toronto Police Service version of race-based data collection strategy, we have to communicate with the public. And I said that was a must. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, Rianne, it was hard. I was in the center of all very heated discussions. And I use that term very politely. You know, people were angry at us. How dare we collecting stats? Because in their world, collecting stats is going to be more, it's more to stigmatize, segregate. So, because they look at it that way. So we have to first to communicate. And that's why I say communication is very important. Those were very difficult conversations for me to have with community members. And, you know, I appreciate, you know, everyone's lived experiences. And coming from war-torn country where police officers are as bad as criminals. And I'm here to set it up. So, but I have to make sure they understand we're collecting the stats. The stats could be ugly. And I can tell you the Toronto Police Service will be releasing our stats. And you have seen some across the provinces already. They're ugly. And the public will say, oh, we told you so. But we're not using that to say, well, the reason we're strip searching certain communities because you committed more crime. No, that's not how we're going to look at it. We're going to look at why are we strip searching more people from certain community? What are our actions? What are our biases? What are some of our procedures and governance? So we have to make sure we have to correct ourselves. So that's where the race-based data is important. So that was one. This is something that is dear to my heart. And I wish the team every success. Mm-hmm. And it's important for future generations to understand and for us to self-check our biases and our actions. Okay.
Yeah, it's critical.
Critical. So community, so we have enlisted a list of excellent community members as a community advisory panel to give us insight and input and inform us in terms of our methodologies and how we look at these critical data. So that's one aspect. You know, neighborhood policing, you know, started in 2013, and I had the pleasure to continue to expand that. Now, this is where reactive policing versus proactive policing. For many years, in the name of technology, and technology is important, but we had made our police officer to be drive-by. Mm-hmm. I take whatever information and I leave. You never see me again. This cannot happen. Has to be after, you know, providing customer service aftercare. So we, you know, Toronto has distinctively over 140 neighborhoods. These neighborhoods are defined not because of crimes. You know, a lot of people say, oh, you're over-policing us. No. These neighborhoods are defined by the city of Toronto through data, through census, you know, ranking, you know, populations, right, ranking immigration status, income, education, you know, crime. And when I tell people, they go, wow, crime severity is actually very low on the totem pole. You look at all the socioeconomic factors. And that's where we put officers in there. You know, this is going back. This is like back to the future. One thing we did well when I joined the Toronto Police Service is we have what we call foot patrol. You know, so now we're putting officers into a neighborhood for a minimum of 4 years. I went to New York. I went to Scotland. I look at, you know, best practices. We're not the best, and I have to learn from the best. So we're putting officers in there for a 4-year stint to get to know the neighborhoods, know the people, know the businesses, know the schools, know the churches, and know the issues. But how do we do it? I said to the team, "We'll go out." They go, "What do you mean, deputy?" It's long. So I remember before we launched this in 2017, I did over 16 community meetings, both from community, tell us, what do you want? What is the mandate of this program? What kind of training you want us to deliver? And what type of officer you want us to pick? Collecting all these, and then I went back to the community and say, we drafted a document. I'm seeking your approval. Unheard of.
Yeah, absolutely.
Unheard of. They said, what? Even at that time, Chief Saunders said, wow, this is unheard of. We're asking the public to agree to what we're doing. I said, yeah, unless they have their approval. Our program is not legitimized. It has to be legitimized with the community and validated by the community. This is what they want. This is not what I want. This is not what the politician want. This is what the public want. These are the officers. This is the job description. These are the training. And these are the officer profile. This is what they agree on.
It's so truly policing with and by consent.
And that's why I said, this is not prescriptive. This is collaborative. So that's something that is dear to my heart. And I know every neighborhood that I visit that have neighborhood officers assigned. Certainly, well, you know, resource is always an issue. We have 140 neighborhoods and more. So we're working at it to expand, to have eventually have a neighborhood officer team in each one of the neighborhoods. But if I can tell you, I go to neighborhoods and visit that have neighborhood officers, people will tell me they know these officers' name. You know, officers are helping young people to seek grants, to write applications, to supporting them for scholarships. This is they are part of the community. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing I'm very proud of. And I hope we will continue that. And one, you know, another file that I close to my heart is the expansion of MCIT. Mental health is a enormous issue in the city of Toronto. We don't need to go far to go walk around downtown. You see a lot of people are suffering from crisis. You know, Toronto Police Service get documented more than 30,000 calls a year, but that's only documented calls. So what we have is a program with a specialized mental health trained nurse and a mental health trained police officer. We call them MCIT teams, and they go and answer to these mental health person in crisis calls. And when I first took over the file, we were only working in certain areas with very restricted hours. But you know what? It's not about me. It's about working with a team, working with the community, working with our partners, hospital. And we're able to advocate for more funding, expand that program to almost 24 hours a day, to 20 hours a day now. So, but if you ask me, and a lot of people have asked, you know, Pete, should police or officer go to mental health calls, person in crisis? And I say, sometimes we do, because some of them really possess it. They do pose a danger to self or others. But a lot larger amount of calls police shouldn't go to. But that's where, you know, when I first became a police officer, that's why we don't leverage other social agencies. Mm-hmm. And this is not a policing issue. Person in crisis, a lot of times are not policing issues. But this is where we need to be the voice, the champion for other agencies to advocate for equal fundings. Mm-hmm. So they have the capacity to deal with these issues in the absence of the Toronto Police Service, because we don't want to do that. It's like people asking me, should we go to homeless person's home? No. Homelessness is not a policing issue. It's a social issue. But if someone is seeing today is very cold. If someone's seeing a homeless person in the middle of the back of the laneway, people would not know to call an agency, mm-hmm. but they would call the Toronto Police Service. So that's where I see our job. You know, I see social services as like multi-sectorial. You know, we're part of the cog. We're just one part of that equation, but it has to be comprehensive, holistic. So we're not the only solution, but our job is to advocate and support other agencies and making sure we get the job done collectively. Certainly, I'd like to see Toronto Police Service be stepping away from calls such as a person in crisis and homeless calls, and where we can address more violent issues such as guns and gangs, traffic, and crime prevention. Mm-hmm. But certainly, the fundings are not, they're finite. So we need to work together. So, you know, these are some of my thoughts as I depart. We have a long way to go. We do. We have a long way to go in terms of looking after social services calls and this multi-sectorial approach. It's the right approach. Everyone has to have the will and also the commitment. And at the end of the day, we will see improvement. I hope the improvement will be a little bit more accelerated, so we can look after people, the people that needs the assistance.
Definitely. I mean, just even as a member of the public, you can see a shift in the discussion around that. And then obviously working within this sector, seeing the power of effective partnership working, there are just so many better outcomes for individuals, for families, and for communities that can result.
A on that note, Brianna, I just want to speak briefly on, the phenomenon of defunding the police. I don't get insulted. And I think we have heard the terms detasking. I just spoke for the past few minutes. We don't need to go to person in crisis calls. We don't need to go to homeless calls. We don't need to go to some of these calls that don't require police officer. But the solution is not that simple. Just let someone else go. We don't have the infrastructure. So I am fully supportive of working, champion, and build those critical infrastructure so it's sustainable and the police can step away from those calls. At the end of the day, if those money can be transferred to those and we truly don't need to go, I'm more for it because we cannot be going to calls. 1987 policing and 2022 policing and 2050 policing will be drastically different. We cannot be just going to the same calls over and over again. Technology can take over. Non-police personnel can take over non-violent. Like if you lost a cell phone, you lost a passport, or your car got damaged, do you really need a police officer wearing a firearm to come and take a report? But this is not called defunding. It's called detasking. Mm-hmm. So I'm very clear on that. I'm fully supportive as long as it's done right. That doesn't impact public safety. And the other people that are picking up these jobs have the proper resources, infrastructure, and be sustainable. So it doesn't end up calling the police back again. Oh, we can't go. We can't do it. And you come again. So that's not how we got to do it properly. That's my thought on defunding. And I would never be the one that would be opposed to taking some, because certainly there are a lot of areas we can do better, preventing gun violence, looking at youth victimizations, cyberbullying, human trafficking, traffic collisions. But if you detach us from some of the other things, we can focus more of our energies on those things.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you say is key. It has to be sustainable. The people need to be there with the right funding, a 24/7 service. And the public also would need to know. I mean, I think the example you gave is right. How many people walking down the street, if they see an issue where there's a homeless person who might need some assistance or a person in crisis, do they know that? I should call this mental health service, or, this is a City of Toronto thing. Oh, I should call them. What's their number again? But you're right. They know the police, whether it's the 911 or the non-emergency number. And you've essentially become the default service because you'll respond. And if that's not there, if that infrastructure is not there for other agencies to respond, that is a serious risk for a reduction in public trust overall for public services.
For sure. So that's where I think the conversation has started. Mm-hmm. And it will continue. And I optimistic solutions will be found and we will be there soon.
So, Peter, I'm curious, just on the defunding and detasking conversation, how are officers taking this kind of broader dialogue? I mean, is it impacting them? Is there a mixed view? I'm curious because obviously we hear from yourself and, your peer police leaders, but how is it affecting the workforce?
Once again, when I was a young police officer and, it's a long time ago, I did not know of these issues. And so first and foremost, I need to educate myself. If you don't educate yourself, you listen to rumors. And back then it was a little bit different because the advent of social medias and group chats, and we didn't have that. So it was just word from different people's mouths. But now information travels very quickly. And if it's a distorted information, it can turn toxic very quickly. Mm-hmm. So it's incumbent on people like myself, people in leadership position, to continue to provide those information. I speak with our people all the time. But that's where leadership is not about what uniform you wear, what title you hold. It's about communicating. It's about communicating genuinely with your people. It's a human relationship. Yes, they are feeling the heat. They are taking it hard, and they believe that they're not doing a good job. That's why people want to, people quote unquote want to take away their money and their privileges. So you have to be both supportive, but you also have to be both honest with them.
Yeah.
Police officers should not be doing certain things. We were not hired to do certain things. And I also got to say this, police officers make a great deal of money. We make very good money. And I often, remind them the power they hold. And then another example, I always say, the last one I did was a couple of weeks ago, and it was a cold morning. I said, how many people got a new car? Put their hands up. you enjoy your new cars, because you know why you got a new car? Because you just hired by the Toronto Police Service. You're making good money. They said, yeah, they were smiling. They didn't know where I'm coming from. Do you drive by bus stop? Yeah. You see how many people going onto the bus in this freezing, frigid weather? You know, people on that bus are making minimum wage. You know, anyone know how much is the minimum wage? You guys are privileged. Don't abuse that privilege and have that conversation. It's not us against them mentality. When people are saying they want to defund the police, understand the narrative and have an honest, educated, informed discussion. It's not about us and them. All right, there are reasons why people are using the term defund. I don't choose the word defund. I choose the word detask. It's the same thing. We cannot continue to do what we continue to do. A lot of things do not need a police officer. But so these it is tough because we have a large organization, and it's spread out. It's not one centralized location. It's spread out throughout the city of Toronto. So information will get distorted. So it's incumbent on leadership to make sure that we keep our folks on track and make sure they have the right information. At the end of the day, they have to choose what they want to believe and what they don't want to believe. So, but our job is to give them that information to be informed.
Definitely, definitely. And I think some of those kind of reality checks and check-ins that you were just describing are critical just to ground them again in the community, in the world that we're living in. So Peter, I think those are some amazing, they sound like legacy pieces and programs that you're leaving to, you know, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, they're not my legacy. They are the Toronto Police Service legacy. And most importantly, they're the public, the community's legacy. You know what? I'm very clear. You know what? Once I leave, there'll be people to do the job, continue the job. And I hope they do a much better job than I. So they're not my legacy. You know, I thoroughly enjoy my career. And it's like anything else. It's cliche-ish. I'm leaving people. You know what I'm going to miss? It's the people. I'm going to miss my internal members and the members of the public. And, you know, I hope I don't stay away from public life. I hope I still can contribute. I am retired, but I don't need to use a senior card yet.
So no, goodness, not at all.
Nothing wrong being a senior, but I'm just saying, I want to be engaged. I want to still participate. And if there's things that I can help, I certainly will lend a hand to, because the city, the well-being of the city matters to me. I grew up in the city and I was given an opportunity to flourish with the Toronto Police Service. A lot of people have given me a chance, maybe once, maybe twice. And I like to give that back to anyone that needs those opportunities, my assistance. So I will be still engaged, and I will be on the sideline as a citizen looking at things with a different lens. And I'm going to remind myself, it's always easy to be the critics. I always say that, you know, you're the opposition party, you're always easy to criticize until you sit in that chair. So I'm very mindful of that. It's been giving me, I travel around the city, met a lot of great people. And most importantly, I made a lot of good connection with community members and understanding their lives and getting to know some of the young people, the family. So, you know, it's been a pleasure. I wish we could turn the clock back, but we can't. And so, you know, life moves on, and it's been a great career. I would not trade it for anything else. Definitely not for an engineering job.
I feel like this is not to knock engineers, but I feel like this has been perhaps a bit more exciting.
If they're listening to this, no, that's not, because I have many friends that are engineers. So and and you know what? I'll tell you this. You know, my son it was an engineering. So the station So I said to my son, I said, Ryan, you know what? So the station he assigned to is being built, a new station. Because of his engineering background, he's now on the steering committee.
Oh, wow.
So I said, you know what? You can always use information, you know, from university, as you're now a police officer. So see how convenient that your boss said, hey, Ryan, you got an engineering degree. We'd like you to sit on the planning committee that we're doing building the new station properly. So you never know. You know, I think, my parting words, if I have any, is like, I have a lot of hope for the city. I really hope that there are a lot of work to be done about equality, equity. Please continue to speak up. Please continue to challenge what's not right and also have the courage to support each and each other. Because, you know, we have to make, you know, when I first started the job, certainly, you know, it was very obvious discrimination and racism within the Toronto Police Service. If you ask me, have we rid of it? I would say to you, no. But now it's more overt, not, you know, more concealed. So, but we need to continue to build on that to make sure to understand equality and equity as two separate things, two different things. You know, make sure we strive towards the best city, the best organization, and, you know, so for future generations. So, because what we're seeing right now, I think if we don't take it back, we don't take a step back and say, it sickens me to see some of the words are spoken, some of the actions. And, you know, last couple of days I've seen middle schools that they use their anti-Semitism. It is horrible. Like, what is this? What is our city becoming? So, you know, I will continue to provide my advice if people need it. But I hope, you know, this city can be strong and can move forward. We cannot be divided. And if that takes 10 years, 20 years, then it will take 10, 20 years, but we got to get it done.
Yeah. So, the problem not only worth solving, it's essential to solve and move on. You know, Peter, I'm just curious, actually, you know, as you were talking about some of the discrimination that you faced, especially early on in your career, like how did you cope with it? How have you persevered through it and addressed it, both like internally, because just the stress and the trauma from that over years, and also worked through it in the police service more generally?
Well, first, in the early days, I don't speak to it. You internalize it, but you also say to yourself, you know what? It wasn't even the police service, even in schools, you know, going through grade school and high school, university was a little different. But you need, it's the old saying, you know, as a racialized person, you have to work doubly hard. And I did. So I worked, you know, my tails off and worked very hard and let my work speak for myself. So, and when the group sees that, hey, this kid works hard, this kid is kicking it on the chin and he's not complaining. But that's the coping mechanism back then. But right now, I certainly do not tell young people to do that. You know, working hard is essential, but you also have to speak up. You also have to seek help with your supervisors, with your peers, and to address what's not right. So it was hard. I'm not going to, be gentle and sugarcoat it. It was hard. You also understand, role modeling was very important. It's very important to young people. When I became a police officer, there were very few Chinese officers. There were no role models for me because none of them looked like me. Mm-hmm. So now, you know, in the past 20 years, I have acted as a mentor. I had no mentor. So, but I did come across some non-Asian officer, you know, my coach officer. But some people, I'm not saying that I joined a racist organization. There are some people, they're very good. There are many people that were very good. So I learned from them. But I also understood that mentoring, role modeling is very important. You know, the last couple of days at work, a civilian employee said to me, "Deputy, you're leaving." I said, "Yeah, you know what, it's time." And the employee says, "You know what, I go home and tell my kids, you can aspire to be Deputy Ewan." And I said, "Well, you know what, first of all, I thank you very much for that compliment." Mm-hmm. You know, because this employee's kids want to be a police officer. And she tells them, "You can inspire to be him, to sit on the seventh floor, to be a command officer." So I always knew role modeling is impactful. So I try to do that to help them to get through whatever racism, systemic barrier. So it's about the conversations, about talking through issues, getting them to a better place. I did not have that. So it was hard. I learned on my own. And luckily, I hope I did okay. But my answer to you is definitely mentoring, setting a role model. So when I go to community, into communities and asking the mothers, give your kids to the Toronto Police Service. We want them. And I know I've been challenged many times. Why would we give our kids to you when they're all just low entry level workers? I said, no. They can aspire to be who they want to be. Mm-hmm. I said, I am an example for you. Certainly nothing is going to be handed to you on a, you know, but you have to work hard. Mm-hmm. So this is one thing about this country is that if you work hard, I wouldn't say 100%, 99%, 95%, you get to where you want to get to. So one person said to me before I left, she sent me a message, Deputy, we really see you go. You have impacted so many people's lives. I said, you know what? Thank you for that. But now you know what? It's your turn to carry on that impact, impact others. You know, if I impacted you, then you now look at all the positives that I taught you, I hope, and then that you can impact other people, because that is a continuation. It's a continuous thing. It's not, it doesn't stop. I hope I pass on some of my traits so you can impact, but you have to be a mentor. You have to be a role model. You have to be the best you can. You know, we sometimes all have bad days. It's okay to have bad days, but you know, people look to you. So do the best you can. So that's how I would say address what, how we can move forward.
Those are some very, very wise words, Peter. And one of the, I mean, definitely one of the things I also wanted to ask you, because I know you've had such an interesting career with so many interesting roles, like your time undercover and lots of other aspects. I'm just wondering if there are any experiences or cases that have, you know, stayed with you, or they stand out in your mind, and why that is.
There were many cases, both in organized crime, undercover, my brief stay at homicide, professional standards. They're all unique cases. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, all these cases came to a successful resolution was through the teamwork of all the members of the service plus the community. So if you ask me any stand out, you know, it's not, you know, I don't have, you know, they're all unique on its own. Mm-hmm. And, you know, every posting that I was privileged to be assigned to brings a lot of good memories. But also, you know what? After 35 years, and I say to myself, why would I do that? I would not do that again, working like 80 hours straight. Like, was I stupid? No, so, no, but at that time, you enjoyed it.
Yeah.
You know what? I remember, one thing I am kind of proud of, at that time, I did not know that. Mm-hmm. In 2000, we did a human trafficking sex trade operation, the Project Trade. That was the first time that we infiltrated a number of Asian organized crime members, bringing in Thai girls, and they were kept captive and took passports taken. And at that time, I treated the girls like, you know, sex trade workers. Mm-hmm. That's when I came to realization, you're wrong, Pete. They're human beings. They're victims. They've been exploited. They're kept. They're kidnapped. They were trafficked from Cambodia, from Thailand. They don't speak a word of English, and they are actually victims. They are not sex trade workers. Mm-hmm. So this is where I first started to learn empathy and understanding. And looking at things differently. And when I saw, you know, there was huge takedown, when I saw some of the officers treating them like, you know, substandardly, I said, hang on a minute. It's not how it's supposed to be. They are victims. They, you know, I remember speaking to a young Thai girl, and she didn't speak a word of English. It impacted me a lot. It still impacts me. You know, people will think that I'm soft. I'm not. She showed me a picture. I said, what is this? A little baby. Could be 6 months old. I asked the interpreter, what is this? The young lady said, immediately after she gave birth to her daughter, she was sold by her parents. And she went to Saudi Arabia, she went to Europe, and then she came to Canada. She never saw this kid. And this kid is 6 months old now. And a year later, this young lady passed away, HIV.
Oh, that's
not. That's why I said to myself, you know, I can get to go home and see my family. Mm-hmm. This young lady You know, she was 17 years old. I said, well, what is this? Mm-hmm. This is the misery. This is the lowest point, you know, I was as a cop. And I said, no, this is where my empathy, you know, I didn't understand what empathy was. Mm-hmm. That's why I drive that into it with the new recruits. Understand your words, your actions means a lot. Adversely or positively, don't waste that opportunity. All right. So I didn't, you know, I don't know if that was any great deed I did, you know. Yeah, we collected a bunch of money, the whole unit, and sent it back home. That's the least we can do to her family, but the least we can do. But, you know, I know that it's not, it will never be enough. But I just said, human beings shouldn't be treated like this.
Yeah.
But what, it continues. So I did not. So you look back, I did not make any inroads. But I did push for new trafficking laws in Canada. And so I hope I have contributed somewhat to the criminal code, the trafficking law. But, you know, but these things continue. So, you know, the world needs police officer. Yeah.
You do. It's
the world is not, it's not as simple as get rid of police officer and the world will be fine. It's not. There are still a lot of egos out there. We're not crusaders. We're not bad men. We're not Spider-Man. There are a lot of egos out there, and they do need us. So, so I hope, you know what, the new generation police officer can rebuild that trust, and also the public give us a chance. You know, we're doing a lot of good things. But most importantly, hold us accountable. You know, I am a person that police very, very, very sternly with oversights. We need to be governed. So please, you know, give us the feedback. Mm-hmm. Your accolades. I need to hear criticism. Well, you know, that's when I used to say as a police officer, hopefully I will be giving some my informed advice if anyone chooses to hear. So I, like I said to you, Rian, I intend to stay active. I don't know if, you know, could be through teaching, could be through social justice, sector, so we'll see.
Well, I know I'm really looking forward to seeing what your next chapter looks like, because you have that ethos of public spirit, and you're too young just to sail off into the sunset. So we need you in this city. There's a lot to be done, and I know you have some fantastic ideas and a lot of energy to do it. But I do hope you take a couple of months to have a bit of a rest, because it's been a tough 2 years, even just thinking about living through this pandemic. So I hopefully
we can go travel a little bit.
And then yes, I know that you have some spots you'd like to go to. So I really hope that you can find some time to do that. And Peter, thank you just not only for giving me the honor of being, you know, your last interview. And I hope this has been kind of a good retrospective of some of the things that you've accomplished and things you're proud of, but also just a big thank you for all of your service to the city and policing more generally. You've made a huge impact on a lot of different people in the service and outside in the communities and different organizations. And you set up a lot of great things and inspired a lot of change. So take that with you, and just a big thank you, and wish you all the very best as you go forward. So stay in touch with me and others, and looking forward to seeing what's next for you.
Well, definitely. Before I end this, you know, thank you for this, Rian. You've been a great friend, a great supporter, and great, you know, giving me some great advice throughout the years. And certainly I will not be a stranger. I think I still owe you a coffee. And so we'll get together, and hope to see you very soon. And thank you for giving me this opportunity to sign off, you know, my last interview as a Toronto Police Service member. So it's been a privilege. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter. All the best.
All the best. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you've enjoyed it, we'd love for you to leave a rating and a review on whichever podcast platform you're listening on. This will really help us spread the word to more friends and family. Thanks, and another episode will be available very soon.